I'm Alex Grant, and this is the Law of the Case podcast for February 28th, 2024. Now, it seems that the election interference case against former President Trump in Georgia has taken a sharp detour into what looks like an episode of Melrose Place or the Jerry Springer Show. How did we get here? In this episode, I dig into what you would need to know to find out the facts behind the conflict of interest motion, if you were interested in knowing what the facts are. Almost all of the commentary on this issue has been divided on intensely partisan lines, with the op-ed pages, cable news, and podcasts filled with voices analyzing the alleged conflict of interest involving District Attorney Fannie Willis and the special prosecutor Nathan Wade in a way that just so happens to line up with how they feel about the case overall and whether or not President Trump should be reelected president. Now, let's be clear. The conflict of interest motion, the merits of the case against Trump, and the political question of who should be elected are totally separate questions. On legal issues like the alleged conflict of interest, most of the commentary is telling people what they want to hear. Turn on Fox for one thing, turn on MSNBC for the other. But a lawyer who tells a client what they want to hear is a bad lawyer. A good lawyer tells the client what they need to hear, the truth. Likewise, a legal expert or a pundit serving up red meat for a polarized audience is not actually benefiting that audience. I'm Alex Grant with Episode 3 of the Law of the Case podcast, here to give you the straight scoop. I spent 23 years in the Department of Justice investigating and prosecuting nearly every kind of criminal case the department handles. In this episode, I draw upon what I learned from investigating tax evasion and money laundering cases to explain to you how you would follow the money to determine whether the testimony of Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade on their use of cash holds water. And we will also talk about the cell tower data analyzed by Trump's private investigator and whether that matters for the motion and what it could mean for Willis and Wade personally. And we will have a special guest, former FBI profiler Julia Cowley, who I worked with when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office. But before we get to Julia and the evidence and the kind of investigation you would do, let's recap the conflict of interest motion and the legal theory that led the trial judge, Scott McAfee, to open up his courtroom and to start hearing testimony from witnesses like District Attorney Willis, Special Prosecutor Wade, Willis's ex-friend, and Willis's father. The motion alleges a conflict of interest or an appearance of conflict interest, although Georgia law seems to indicate an actual conflict of interest must exist. And the lawyers, and in fact, the Georgia Supreme Court has actually allowed two married lawyers to be on opposite sides of the case under the theory that lawyers can separate their personal and professional lives. There's actually a good argument that even if everything that is alleged to be true is true, there's no conflict of interest. But the theory first advanced by Trump's co-defendant Michael Roman and his lawyer Ashley Merchant is this. Number one, Willis had a romantic relationship with Wade before she appointed him to be special prosecutor in 2021. So that appointment decision is tainted under this theory. Number two, Willis was benefiting from that appointment decision because the special prosecutor was giving her gifts in the form of paying for her travel on joint getaways. The theory is that the money Willis is paying to the special prosecutor is flowing into her pockets. These two facts, the timing of the relationship and whether Willis got substantial gifts, are both necessary under the theory of this motion, And again, the prosecution is saying that the theory itself is flawed. But even under the Roman/Trump view of the world, both of those facts are necessary to show this conflict of interest. So if the relationship began before the appointment decision, but there were no substantial gifts to Willis, it would not be enough under the defendant's theory, at least as I read it. The fact that Judge McAfee decided to hear testimony on these issues means something. It means that these facts matter to the motion, or at least potentially matter. That's not quite the same thing as saying that the trial judge agrees with the theory, but it looks that way because otherwise, why hold the evidentiary hearings if these facts don't matter? But I would argue that McAfee had to hold the hearings because Willis and Wade made those facts matter. The fateful step was not the filing of the motion or even the decision to hold the hearings. The fateful step was the district attorney's decision to respond to the motion by including an affidavit from Wade. The affidavit is a sworn statement addressing these two issues. Now, the district attorney asked the court to put a stop to the litigation at that point, which would have required the court to basically take the word of Wade, even though the defense had a very different version of events. I don't know whether District Attorney Willis or Wade ever really thought that was going to work. If they did, they were fooling themselves. A judge is almost never going to accept one version of events without the other side having a chance to challenge it, to cross-examine it. And if these facts don't matter, why did the prosecutors submit the affidavit? The affidavit is a tacit admission that those facts matter. So that's why the affidavit, if this ends up turning out badly for Willis and Wade, will be seen as the point of no return. They could have remained silent on those issues and argued the motion on the legal theory. In other words, even if everything the defense is saying is true, there is no conflict of interest. But remaining silent would have been pretty awkward. A pregnant negative, as lawyers like to say, almost an admission that what has been alleged about the relationship is true. But not filing the affidavit also would have meant that they were not on the line for potentially perjuring themselves. With the affidavit, Wade had to testify, and he had to testify consistent with the affidavit, or else that inconsistency would be solid proof of perjury at that point. And once Wade testified, Willis's testimony was almost a foregone conclusion, and she had to testify consistent with the affidavit, or else her testimony could be used to prove perjury against Wade. Those are the implications of filing that affidavit. Now, if they had refused to answer the factual questions, the worst that could have happened is that both the district attorney and the special prosecutor would be disqualified from the case. And that would probably mean another DA's office in Georgia takes over, and that prosecutor could move forward full steam ahead. Or maybe the case would be delayed, probably would be delayed because the new prosecutor would have to get up to speed on it. Or maybe the new prosecutor would not pursue the case at all. So huge consequences for this potentially historic case. But Willis and Wade would survive to fight another day in other cases. Now, if in the worst case scenario, Willis and Wade are found to have perjured themselves, the state bar authorities are going to get involved and their bar licenses would be on the line. Now, one thing we always operated with at the U.S. Attorney's Office was the belief that nothing you could accomplish in one case was worth putting your bar license at risk. Stay well away from crossing any kind of ethical line. You want to do the right thing, first of all, and second of all, it's just not worth it. Win or lose, you want to go home at the end of the day with your career intact. But what's interesting here is in fighting this conflict of interest motion, the prosecution has three different interests, maybe four, that they are trying to advance or protect. And when you're trying to accomplish different goals other than just winning the case in the courtroom, according to the rules of criminal procedure and the rules of evidence, the defense has gained an advantage. So that means an advantage for defendants like Trump and Roman. So first, the district attorney's office, they're trying to protect the case against Trump and his co-defendants that they have indicted. They believe in the case. They want to pursue the case. So they're their interests of the case. Now, second, as I mentioned, Wade and Willis want to avoid consequences to themselves professionally with the judge and potentially bar authorities. Third, Willis is an elected DA, and it was clear from her testimony that she was speaking to an audience beyond the courtroom. She wants the approval of her constituents, or maybe Georgians more generally, in the event she will seek office higher than being the DA of Fulton County. And fourth, Wade has his own reputational interests, which may or may not coincide with Willis's interests, especially since it seems that they are no longer dating. The reason I mention these different interests or different agendas is that I see things in the way the DA's office is responding to this motion that may work for one purpose or one audience, but not for the other. Take Fannie Willis's televised testimony 2 weeks ago. From the standpoint of a witness in the courtroom, her demeanor and her way of answering or frankly not answering questions, well, it was terrible. As a prosecutor, I would never want a witness that I put on the stand to be engaging in personal comments back to the lawyer doing the questioning. She was telling Ashley Merchant that her motion was full of lies. It's not the job of the witness to talk about what is in the other side's arguments in their papers. That's for argument. The witness's testimony is for facts. And when she was testifying, Willis was avoiding questions, going on monologues about what she wanted to talk about. Now, to some of the pundits writing on op-ed pieces, op-ed pages, and probably to many of her constituents who are not tasked with dealing with the specific issues in the motion, that all probably sounded great. She showed a side of herself, an independent professional woman that was quite appealing. Testifying in court is a lot different from getting on CNN and arguing and interrupting and talking over people. So let's take also the DA's office's written responses to Trump's lawyer when they offered the new cell tower evidence. This was just a few days ago. Some of that written response was your basic legal argument about the rules. But then they started arguing about what else the cell tower evidence might show. That means might show besides the fact that Willis and Wade seemed to be spending time together in the early morning hours. And at one point in this written response, the DA's office resorted to putting its words in bold, underline, and all caps. That is quite the trifecta. And something I have never seen in over 30 years in the law. In the world of court documents, it comes across as unhinged. I can't imagine they thought that was the best way to engage and persuade Judge McAfee. I've seen this kind of writing in some of their other responses, and it does not come across as being professional. But again, maybe they were speaking to a wider audience. And finally, the hearing yesterday involving the testimony of Wade's former law partner, who had previously told Ashley Merchant that the relationship had begun before Willis took office as DA. Something clearly had happened because this former law partner, who was cooperative enough to look over Merchant's motion in January and to proofread it for accuracy, was probably the most evasive witness you could imagine. And the lawyer in the courtroom for the DA's office was trying to throw up every roadblock to finding out what the facts were on this issue. the lawyer for the DA's office made all kinds of speaking objections, which were basically coaching the witness. Merchant eventually objected to these speaking objections, and the judge tried to rein it in, but the lawyer for the DA's office never stopped. It was kind of gross and totally unprofessional for a prosecutor, in my opinion. When I was a prosecutor with the Department of Justice, you would hear these improper speaking objections, but never as persistent and as long-winded and as egregious as what I heard yesterday. But you would hear these improper speaking objections from the defense, not from the prosecutor's office. The prosecutor's office, you have a duty not just to be a zealous advocate, but to seek justice and to play by the rules. You are held to a higher standard. You would have these exchanges yesterday where Merchant would ask a simple factual question. There would be a long speaking objection. The judge would overrule the objection, and then the witness would say he forgot the question. This happened over and over again. The hearing took about 2 hours, and had the witness not been so evasive, had there not been so many speaking objections, you could have gotten it done in 10 or 15 minutes. Now, these are scorched earth tactics that do not reflect well on the district attorney's office's reputation. And guess what? There will be lawyers from the DA's office in cases less noteworthy than this, and they're going into court the next day and the day after that. And guess what? You've made their jobs harder because the judges are not going to have the same trust and esteem for the DA's office after seeing the conduct that you saw yesterday and through the litigation of this motion. But this podcast is about this case and this conflict of interest motion. And we will move on and talk about the types of evidence that could still prove or disprove these two critical factual issues. And again, the two issues are, when did the relationship begin? And second, did Fannie Willis financially benefit from that appointment of Mr. Wade? And with that, we will talk to FBI profiler Julia Cowley. With Julia Cowley of The Consult, her own podcast, and former FBI agent, former supervisor, former FBI profiler. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to see you, although I just saw you the other day.
That's right.
We've known each other for a while.
That's right. So, Julia, as I laid out in the first part of the podcast, this motion that alleges a conflict of interest, it kind of focuses on two factual issues. And so I wanted to talk to you about how you would deal with that investigatively. And those two issues, just to recap, is when did this relationship begin? And then second, did Fannie Willis benefit? And again, this sort of goes to, did she get money or did she get trips or did she get something like that from the prosecutor, special prosecutor Nathan Wade? So, Julia, just maybe before we start, try to frame this a little bit for us. This is an investigation, but how does it differ from some of the investigations that you did into things like cash and facts like that?
Well, I think what I'm noticing about this, and first of all, I just want to make sure everyone knows I'm not an attorney, and I'm just observing this as a former FBI agent and investigated white collar as well in public corruption, but it seems it's the tables have turned a little bit because the side that's normally on the prosecution side is on the defensive right now. And then you have the defendants who are more on the, the prosecution side. And they are the ones at this point trying to prove certain aspects as opposed to the prosecution side that's trying to defend that. And so they are conducting an investigation. And I think what's a little bit different, as I see it, is that they don't have the resources necessarily that they would have if they were on the law enforcement side. That's what it seems to me. So they're limited in what they could find. So, you know, on the law enforcement side, we'd have a lot of resources available to us to get, you know, a lot of information. And I feel like some of the information that they've uncovered, it seems important, it seems relevant to the case, but is it enough? I don't know. I think there would be more that I would be looking for, but I think their hands are tied. I'm not sure they have that ability in their position as the actual defendants, but they're also on the offensive at this point. So if hopefully that makes sense, but
yeah,
that's how
no,
I'm viewing it. It's sort of backwards from what you and I would normally see in a case and how we would approach it. They can't necessarily approach it the same way that we would be able to.
Yeah. Just to put a sharper point on that, if I was the assistant U.S. attorney and you were the FBI agent, we'd be able to conduct an investigation sometimes covertly. So the people that we're investigating don't even know that we're investigating them, right? There's a process to compel testimony of witnesses through the grand jury. And again, that's not necessarily known to the person being investigated. We can obtain search warrants. We can literally go into somebody's phone or house to obtain records. And in fact, we can get some very specific location data relating to cell phones from the cell phone companies. So I think your point is exactly right. This is in a different procedural posture, and their tools are not the same tools that we would have had if we were investigating, say, a illegal business that was using cash.
Correct. Yeah. And you're right. Not having the ability to get a search warrant to be able to get the context and the content of text messages. And like you said, putting people in front of a grand jury, compelling testimony from potential witnesses. I mean, obviously they are putting witnesses forward, but it's a little bit different. And I think they're limited with who they can call and who they're going to call. So I think it's challenging, but all those things that you've pointed out in terms of, you know, trying to establish how far a particular relationship goes back, we would really be unlimited in what we could do. I mean, obviously we would have to follow all legal procedures with subpoenas and search warrants, and we'd have to have probable cause for all of that. And it can't just be a fishing expedition. It has to go to the elements of the crime that we're trying to prove. And I certainly think if they had access to text messages, that might answer a lot of questions. I think some of the evidence that they've already uncovered suggests that, you know, perhaps a time frame of when the relationship at least was ongoing at one particular time. And it really is circumstantial evidence, but that can be very powerful evidence as well.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. You know, if you think about a relationship, a romantic relationship, and I think that's the term they've been using in these hearings. I think in the filings, they also referred to a personal relationship. So these terms are a little squishy, but you know, the parties are, you know, in terms of going back, like, let's think of the evidence that they do have, right? So Trump's lawyer got a subpoena, sent it to AT&T, and the private investigator did some analysis of the records that they got back. And one thing that was pretty clear, they don't have the content of the text message, but there are a great number of text messages. I think it was like thousands, and then thousands of calls between the two of them over, I don't know, I think a year or two. I don't know. What does that say to you?
Well, I mean, that's a lot. I mean, what I would want to see is, was the case ongoing? I think this is before the case was started. So I'd want to see if there is, that's the same number, if there's a pattern. I mean, it seems like a lot of calls, I mean, I certainly know when I was active in certain investigations and I had a co-case agent or a prosecutor that I was working with or other investigators from other agencies, you know, our text messages and our phone calls, or not necessarily text messages, we always tried to avoid that. But so we don't have, you know, that's just more to produce, right? So, you know, we would have a significant increase in the amount of calls, especially like if we were on surveillance or it was a busy time or we were preparing for trial. So I'd want to look at kind of what's going on, but it seems like an excessive amount, but it could be explained by work that they were doing at the time. It could be they talk a lot and... So, but it does establish, which I think is, you know, common knowledge. And I think they've admitted it. They have been friends for a long time. They've known each other. And so, you know, friends talk too.
Sure. And I guess part of it too would be, because I remember back in the day when I was doing domestic violence cases and sexual assault cases, and the relationship between the parties was very important. And a lot of times we wouldn't have the content of calls or the content of text messages, but you could learn a lot from what they call metadata. So metadata is data about information about data about data. And so like part of that would be the time of the calls, so probably when you were talking on the phone with your co-case agents, there was probably a time limit to that, right? You know, you would expect
it would be mostly within normal business hours, and that unless on a specific day we had an operation, we had to get up really early or something. I mean, it would be the context, but generally, I would not be talking to my coworkers at 2 or 3 a.m.
Yeah. And I think this is one of these things that I think the ordinary person, you know, you apply common sense and you think of your own life. How many people in my life do I call or text that much? Right. I think that's a pretty good guidepost to evaluating this information. Now, some of the other information that Trump's lawyer got from the phone company is cell tower location. And there are limitations to that.
There are.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm not a cell phone expert. I've used the cell phone data in my own cases, and I've had experts help me interpret it. But, when we're using our phones and other devices that can be tracked, they ping off cell phone towers. And I think generally it's thought, you know, you're going to ping off the tower that's closest to you, and that will indicate kind of an area of your location. That's not always the case. I've learned that there could be, based on the terrain, based on building, I mean, you may not be able to be as accurate, and you may not even be pinging off your closest cell phone tower. But I found it to be fairly reliable information. I can't recall ever having a case where cell phone data indicated that someone was in an area at some point in time, and we learned later that was completely wrong. The data was wrong. That's never happened, and I'm not aware. I can't recall a case that at least I was part of where maybe a defendant disputed it. So, you know, in my experience, it's been fairly accurate, but it's not going to tell you exactly where somebody is. I'm not going to just say, okay, they're right there on that little corner right there, right next to that mailbox. And I think in some areas where maybe you do have more cell phone towers, it can be more accurate. So that's the extent of my expertise in cell phone data. And we're fortunate at the FBI. And again, you're looking at the defendants in this case that are conducting their investigation and trying to prove what, that there's a conflict of interest. We have this kind of unlimited access to these experts, not only, the cell phone experts, but forensic accountants. And, we just have these people that we can go to, and people who have these areas of expertise that can not only help us obtain the correct information, because you need to know what to ask for as well. And so, like, what am I asking for? What data? What?
and you have to ask for it the right way too.
Exactly, because you'll get something back. And you're like, I don't know what this is. I didn't ask. And they're like, well, you didn't ask for it the right way, especially when it comes to like computer related stuff. And that was also not my area of expertise. I sound like I had no area of expertise, but exactly. So we would have people, we could ask, like, what am I specifically asking for? And they would help interpret it. And certainly there are sometimes, if you get bank records back or cell phone records back, and they're pretty simple. I'm not, you know, and I can interpret them, and I can, you know, provide a summary to a prosecutor such as yourself about, okay, here's what we've obtained, and here's what we have, and here's what I think it shows. But in the really big, complex cases where maybe you have multiple individuals or companies involved, then, you know, we have a team of people that can work on that.
Sure.
And in some cases, and I'm sure you're aware of, we've had like multiple forensic accountants on cases. And so that's the benefit of working for an agency like the FBI.
Instead of here, where they're relying on a private investigator,
right?
Who's limited. Yeah. But let's go back to the cell tower information. Now, I've used those when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And oftentimes what you do is you get a map with circles on them, you know, which shows you, okay, this is the area that he could have been in. Right. And then beyond that, there's no way that he could be in that. And what I found was that it was usually very powerful when you had multiple data points, right? One ping isn't going to do much for you. You know, pinging repeatedly over a period of time, that's much more persuasive, right?
Right.
And then the other thing that I found about this cell tower data is that when you could combine it with another piece of evidence that you had, it became very persuasive. So
like
for example,
GPS.
Like GPS would be great, but even something like, you know, I remember we were looking, I don't know, this came up a few times actually. We were looking for sex offenders who were not registering where they were supposed to be registering. And we're trying to figure out where they were over a period of time. So you get the cell tower information, you'd see these circles. And then you'd say, okay, well, where do they live? Well, it just so happens the place where they keep pinging is near where they live or where they work. So that lends credibility to the cell tower information. It's not just the cell tower that's telling you them there, that they're there, but this other information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on that score, let me ask you a question about sort of trying to marry up pieces of this cell tower and this metadata. So the investigator said that on a couple of different days, he was able to figure out that the phone of Wade called Fannie Willis late at night, and then he starts pinging off of towers near her condo. And then it stopped pinging at 3:30, 4:30 in the morning. So I don't know, how persuasive is that to you of he drove to her house and he stayed there for a few hours?
As an investigator, that's very persuasive to me. So I mean, I know there's kind of this age old thing where the investigators always think I've made the case and the prosecutors are always not quite.
Somebody like me, pouring cold water on your investigation.
All the time. I mean, I find that very compelling. You have that other bit of information. Is it direct evidence? It's not. But is it strong circumstantial evidence? I would think so. And, it, you know, if there's, you know, let's say they deny I was there, I was somewhere else. Well, then, you know, what evidence do you have to show that they were actually somewhere else in the area and not there? And I think I heard the district attorney or the district attorney or somebody had said that she was not even home and was traveling during this one of the period of times that he was supposedly at her house. So as an investigator, I would want to try to obtain those records. You know, where was her cell phone during the time? And are there travel records? Are there financial records to show that she was traveling? I mean, that's what I would do. I'm not sure they have the ability to do that in this particular case. It's just not a normal criminal case that I would, you know, be able to really, you know, turn over every stone. But those are the things that we would be looking at. But I do find it to be very good circumstantial evidence that, you know, he was over at her place during this period of time. You have not only the call, but you have the movement of the phone from his area to her area. You have it there for a particular period of time, and then you have it leaving back to his area. That is persuasive. Now, is it beyond a reasonable doubt? That's what a judge would have to decide, or a jury would have to decide. I mean, I think if it was a murder case, it might take more.
So yeah.
I think sometimes how persuaded someone would be by the evidence can sometimes be dependent on how severe the crime is and how severe the punishment could be. Somebody might make a determination on a lesser crime that they find that evidence to be persuasive. But if it's a more severe crime, they're not willing to jeopardize someone's life and liberty for their entire rest of their life.
Right.
Just based on that evidence. So,
yeah. Kind of building on your point about the limitations, one of the things that the affidavit of the private investigator said was that he was able to do the analysis for two-day periods. And again, it was sort of in the nature of what we just discussed, pinging repeatedly off of cell towers near her condo in the early morning hours. But again, I think if we were really trying to nail this down, you wouldn't just do it for two-day periods, right? I mean, yes, it would be a lot of work to do the analysis for more days. But the reality is they're trying to not just show where they were on one day. They're trying to show a relationship, a course of conduct. So it's persuasive, but it doesn't, this isn't a, Perry Mason moment. I don't think, but it's certainly, persuasive. And I also think it sort of fits with common sense, right? Like a boyfriend or girlfriend, like before you go over early, late at night or early morning, you'd call first, right? Like that kind of fits in to what we understand human beings do, mm-hmm. and I think that sort of lends some weight to it.
Yeah. And you're right. It's trying to establish a pattern is important. I remember an agent who was a mentor to me once said, three is a pattern. You have to have three for whatever,
it's like. At
least three. You get a pattern. But yeah, establishing a pattern is really important. And it is tough. You only have the 2 days. To try to do that for a lengthy period of time to get this pattern to establish, okay, when did the relationship start? When did it end exactly? What's true? What's not true? That is a significant amount of time and effort, and it's why federal cases take so long, because we do that.
That's
we
right.
often do that. We go above and beyond sometimes, and it can take years and years. And again, I'm not sure, I'm sure that this team of attorneys is being paid well, but they do not have the resources of a large federal law enforcement agency behind them. So the 2 days, it really will just depend on the trier of the case.
Right. And in this case, it's the judge. The judge is deciding. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to decide whether they're guilty of crimes. They're trying to see, is there a basis for disqualification? But let's move on to the other part of the investigation that you would do, which is the financial part. And I think, a few heads were turned when there was this talk of large amounts of cash being used to reimburse. And in a day and age where everybody's sort of getting away from cash, you know, you have Venmo, you know, like it's interesting. Like if you need to pay somebody back, it's hard. You hardly ever do it in cash, right? I'm actually one of the holdouts. I don't believe in Venmo, but everybody's doing things like that, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly for large amounts, right? 1,000, 2,000. And actually, and to that point, why don't we play a clip from Fannie Willis's testimony where she talks about using cash. And then we can talk about how you'd investigate it.
County that was paid. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about outside of that, did you ever pay him anything other than cash?
I've only given cash a few times in the course of what we're talking about.
So
if we would go to dinner,
let her finish her answer.
If we would go to dinner, I wouldn't give him cash because he paid for dinner or I paid for dinner. I've given him cash only a few times in life, probably four.
Okay.
Probably the most money I've ever handed him is $2,500. The least amount of money I've handed him, probably between $500 and $1,000.
You never wrote him a check?
Ma'am, I don't have checks.
Okay. So you have no proof of any reimbursement for any of these things because it was all cash, right?
The testimony of one witness is enough to prove a fact.
So my question was, do you have any proof?
Is that what you're intimating right here?
I'm asking if you have any proof that you paid him any of these
money. The proof is what I just told you.
All right. So that was some interesting testimony. I guess I was a little surprised when she said she doesn't have checks. I'm not sure. That's the first person I've heard who has a bank account and no checks. But I don't know. What do you make of that testimony? How plausible is that to you, Julia?
Well, I'm not going to completely discount it because as a white collar investigator, one of the things that we would do is we would review suspicious activity reports from the banks, which they're required to file, and they would send suspicious activity reports if someone's depositing a large amount of cash or someone came in and they said, okay, I'm going to have to file a cash transaction report. People will then start to structure money because they don't want the report to go to the government. And so there's a lot of reasons. And what I did learn is that surprisingly, a lot of people, and particularly I'd say elderly people, do deal with cash. They feel safer. They keep it in their homes. I'm not sure that that's safe, but that's how they feel. That's how they were raised. And so we would sometimes get these suspicious activity reports that were so strange, you know, that the bank would say, oh, somebody came in with this large amount of cash and then it was in a big suitcase and they walked out. They didn't want to deposit it after I said I had to do a cash transaction report. We go talk to them and there'd be a plausible explanation. It wasn't related to criminal activity. And that's what we're looking for. Is there a criminal activity going on? And so I don't discount it just automatically. I think for a lot of people, especially maybe the younger folks, find that implausible. But I can't just say it's completely implausible based on my experience for, you know, 20 years of seeing that, you know, over 20 years of seeing the strangest things. And there's always like a plausible explanation.
Sometimes
there is, and you're just like, oh, okay, I guess that makes sense. I that's not how I would do it, but
right.
You know, and certainly if she was reimbursing him in cash, you know, that just makes it much more difficult. When you have a digital transaction, obviously that's very easy. And, you know, oftentimes if you are trying to do something illicit, you do use cash. So, but we, you know, we can't say that with certainty, but I think some people will automatically think that what's going on? Why are you using cash? What are you trying to hide? What don't you want, you know, as made a record? You don't want a digital record of something. So it certainly does make trying to trace something like that much more difficult.
Yeah. So the thing that makes cash the go-to method for people engaged in illegal activity is that it doesn't leave a record trail, right? Mm-hmm. So if you go in and you receive cash, who's to say that you received it? If you go into a store and you buy something with your cash, what record is that you bought it, So that's helpful. And by the way, I do agree with you on the use of cash. I don't think it's inherently implausible. I mean, some people do like to use cash. I've certainly run into that, in the course of my career at the U.S. Attorney's Office. But let's talk about what sorts of records that would help illuminate this question. Mm-hmm. Because this feels like a little bit easier case, right? If you and I were when we were a prosecutor and agent, if we were investigating an illegal business that was generating cash, you would have cash going in and then you'd try to trace where the cash was going, right? Mm-hmm. Here, the money that's coming in is from a bank, right? They're getting paid by the DA's office. That's going through a bank. And so you would need to find out what's going on with, how is it coming out? So,
yeah, I mean, doesn't that see the patterns of cash withdrawals and deposit? I would want to see those patterns. And, you know, the other thing I would want to know, interviewing other people, other witnesses that she's had either relationships with, or I should say anyone, if, you know, just in this situation, other people she's had relationships with, whether business or personal, is she known to pay cash? Is this a pattern of behavior? That would be really important to me to establish at least whether I believe that that is credible or not. And if there's a pattern of that, I'm like, okay, that's sounding more credible to me. If like, I've never seen her with cash, she's always paid credit card. It's just very strange. And
yeah,
but I would definitely want to see, has there been a withdrawal of some of the same amount of cash? What's going into the account? And I mentioned the FBI has forensic accountants. We, you know, do a complete audit and they're very good. They have programs, they have abilities, and they also work with prosecutors to get subpoenas and search warrants for accounts. They can identify more accounts that we may not know exist. And then, you know, look at credit card records. Are there, you know, cash being taken out on credit cards? What are their credit reports suggest? You know, what's their pattern of spending? All of these things you would want to know to determine, is this a plausible explanation or is this not really fit with the evidence we're seeing, you know, that we've gathered so far?
Yeah, that's, you know, when I was thinking about it, the one thing that would sort of nail this down to show that she was lying about it is that if you got her bank records and there were no cash withdrawals, right?
Right.
I mean, that I think that would be the case where you'd say, okay, this didn't happen, right?
Right.
Now, if you did see some cash withdrawals, then that doesn't necessarily prove that she was paying him back in that way, but at least it makes it possible. Right. And I think what they're hamstrung by is that Fannie Willis is trying to fight them on getting the records. So they can't do the job that you talked about, like the forensic accountant. I mean, a forensic accountant can't do much without the records, right?
Right.
So again, like it's almost like, what is it? X-Files, the truth is out there, but, you know, we don't know it, mm-hmm. based on some of the limitations that they have in trying to show this. But what about the other end of it? What about Wade? What would you, you know, what would you be looking for in his records? What would tend to bolster or undermine this
again
story?
Deposits, you know, looking at his bank deposits and seeing if, you know, if he's taking that money. I mean, you know, in her testimony she said, I think the most I gave was $2,500. I mean, that's a lot of cash to carry around, but it's not, again, it's not like, oh, no way. He could just decide, I'm not going to deposit. I'm not going to go to the trouble, and I'm just going to pay cash with everything that I do for the next, you know, a few months or whatever. You know, that's possible. But I would definitely want to see his deposits. I'd also, you know, again, if I was able to go out and interview witnesses, was he walking around with a lot of cash recently? And was he paying cash? And does he store cash anywhere? I mean, those are the questions I would start to ask, because it may not be a pattern for him to always have a lot of cash on him. And all of a sudden he has a lot of cash. That would bolster her testimony that she paid him back with cash.
Yeah, I think his records would actually be a little less helpful in that if you saw the, well, I guess if you saw some deposits, you might think, okay, that would tend to support it. But if you didn't see the deposits, he could have done what you were talking about. Well, instead of using my credit card when I'm at the grocery store, I just pull out cash and I pay for something. Mm-hmm. You know, that wouldn't be a crazy thing to do if you had $2,500 in cash, right?
Yeah.
You know, just to pay for everyday expenses, in which case you would never see that hit his bank account.
Right. And, you know, another thing you could look at too, if he said, well, I just, you know, I spent it all. Like, let's say you go and ask, okay, where is the cash you gave me? Well, I spent it. You know, where'd you spend it? And you sort of nail down where he might have spent. And then, you know, go back and look at his history of spending. You know, is he continuing to, you know, use his credit card at Starbucks at the same amount? Or is he, you know, does that match up with what he told us of how he was spending his money? And if you don't really see a change in spending habits, then, you know, that could be potential information. It's not the smoking gun by any means, but it could, you know, again, it could help paint the picture of what really happened.
Yeah. So, well, let's wrap up here. And I'll just pose to you the question that Judge McAfee is going to have to decide. Now, he has differing witness testimony, right? There's the ex-friend who says that, yes, they were in a relationship. You have the two of them saying that they weren't in a relationship. You have this cell tower information, which lends some weight to the ex-friend, right? How do you think the judge will come down on it? And I don't think it's going to be a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. I don't think it's that high. I think he's going to be deciding things to a preponderance. I don't know. Let me just ask you, as an investigator, how do you come out on this? I mean, would you think that they were in a romantic relationship or not sure?
Yes, I do think so. And I know that because they've admitted to it. I guess the question is, was it before he was hired?
Right. The timing of it. Yeah, that's a good
timing.
That's really the question.
Correct. And I think that was the point. Is it before he was hired or after? And you know, the defense has... The defendant's attorneys and investigators have put forth some evidence that I think is persuading to me that they might have had a relationship prior to his being hired. Now, is it to the point where I could find that to be a fact? I really don't know. I think just my common sense, I'd probably say, yeah, I think they were probably in a relationship longer than or prior to him being hired. So that would be what I would say as a person sitting in the courtroom observing that
right.
They had a relationship longer than what they say.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of looks that way. And the thing that I'm thinking about is, what's their escape valve? Like, you know, they're thinking of, I always think of, you know, what is your, like, what's your story? What's your cover story? Right. And, or maybe it's legitimate, but what if it comes down to their subjective, definition of what a relationship is? You know, we talked at the beginning of this romantic relationship. We talk about personal relationship. I remember one time when I was a prosecutor, this goes back quite a few years. I was actually examining a witness, and laying like a background question. So I said, Miss So-and-so, I understand you were in a relationship with Mr. So-and-so from this point to this point. I thought this was sort of, you know, kind of uncontroversial. A romantic relationship was a defined term. And we just wanted to make sure that that's what we were talking about. And she clapped back at me and said, what are you talking about? There was no romance. This wasn't a romantic relationship. We had sex, but there was no romance. So the point is that sometimes these terms mean different things to different people. And, you know, maybe you know, the course of this relationship subjectively meant something to them at the time that, I don't know, reasonable people would disagree with. Or maybe this is the cover story. I don't know. What do you think about that theory?
Well, I think that's a good point, because we don't know how they're determining relationship. I think you kind of have to be pretty specific about it. But you know, I think that you reminded me, on my own podcast, we covered the murder of Lisa Ziegert and the arrest of her murderer, Gary Shera. And at the time Gary was arrested, he had a girlfriend and they had been together for a while. And by, you know, they didn't live together, but he would stay over with her and they went out to dinner and movies and all of that, but they did not have a sexual relationship. So, you know, they were considered a couple and they felt they were both in a romantic relationship, but there was no sexual relationship. He didn't want one. So is that, you know, I guess everybody has a different take on what that means in a relationship. So, I mean, in a way, everybody's in a relationship with somebody in some form.
Right, yeah.
You know, whether it's a friendship, whether it's a emotional relationship, whether, you know, that it's, there's just different definitions. So they might need to clarify what they mean. And is that defined under the law some way in Georgia? Like what constitutes a relationship?
Or a romantic relationship.
A romantic relationship. What does that mean? Are there legal standards? I don't know. I think many of us sort of intuitively understand what that should mean. But you know, legally, you have to be able to define it.
Yeah. You know, one thing that strikes me too about this particular situation, I mean, he was married at the time and he's seeing her. I'm not, like, in our culture, I'm not even sure what you call that, right? Like, are they boyfriend, girlfriend, mistress, paramour? I mean, like, the fact that you have trouble even coming up with a word for it kind of shows you that this, I'll use the word association, it kind of has some fuzzy edges to it.
Yeah,
you know, like,
I was going to say it's blurred.
Yeah,
the
blurred.
Blurred,
right.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Right. I like the term paramour, but paramour doesn't necessarily mean, you know, one person's married or not. So I don't know if that mistress or I don't know what the exact term boyfriend, girlfriend. I mean, I guess you could say she was his girlfriend, but they might not define it that way.
That's right.
So
that might give them the leeway to say, look, because here's the thing, as I said in the first part of the podcast, the repercussions to the two of them, if they're found to have given false testimony about this, and unfortunately, this is just the type of topic that witnesses lie about, right? And the repercussions could be severe to them. But I could see the judge kind of giving them an out. And it's like, look, what I think was going on was a romantic relationship as the law sees it or as I see it, but maybe you didn't see it that way. And so therefore you didn't intentionally perjure yourselves. And that sort of gives everybody a way to walk away from this case or walk away from the decision without major ramifications.
Yeah. I have no idea how he'll decide. And you have that second part of it as well. Was there a benefit? And,
right.
Or, you know, and I think it, you know, that's going to be the more complicated decision, the second half of the part of the case. I think it's a little more complicated and certainly the, you know, I'm not familiar with the laws in Georgia, but they're very specific and he's going to go exactly, okay, here's what the law says. And this either meets it or doesn't meet it. So, you know, in any case, in terms of public officials, we're always just looking for that quid pro quo. Is someone getting a personal benefit, you know, by misusing their position?
Now, let me ask you a question.
That's kind of the bottom line.
You know, let me ask you a question. because it kind of feels like Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade are kind of okay with leaving the record murky on both of these questions of when the relationship started or whether they got the money. So you heard Ashley Merchant act, well, do you have proof, right? Do you have proof to show that you did it? Well, no, I don't. And I must say, as somebody who was a prosecutor, and I'll just ask this of you as a federal agent, I mean, if my integrity were questioned, it would not be good enough that you couldn't prove it, right? I would want to prove the opposite. I would want to make it clear beyond any kind of doubt that I had acted properly and that there's no there at all. And yet they seem to be okay, because they don't want the records to come out, of just sort of leaving it a little murky. I don't know. What do you think? Like, I mean, you know, just as an agent, like, how would you feel like if your integrity were impugned in this way?
I'd feel the exact same way. I would not. I mean, that's one of the tenets of being an FBI agent, is being honest and integrity. You know, obviously that's part of our motto, you know, integrity, and my integrity is very important. And I would be the same way. I'd want to give all the proof that I was telling the truth. I wasn't lying. I would give access to whatever was needed to prove that I wasn't lying, because that's the most important thing. And as an FBI agent, and I have unfortunately seen this, not a lot in my career, but once you've lost your integrity, you're just not capable of doing your job anymore. You can't testify. You have this problem of, you know, following you around the rest of your career. You have to disclose that somehow you lied somewhere, or were found to have, you know, perjured yourself or something. You can lose your job right, as well. So it's, you know, integrity is extremely important. Yeah, it's really, it's, I just can't imagine sitting there,
yeah, really,
having someone, you know, attacking my integrity and knowing I have, you know, I have the truth behind me. But when you have the truth behind you, it's just, you know,
you just lay your cards on the table.
Right, right. And, you know, one thing I will say is that sometimes people do lie, and that maybe they're not lying about something, but there's something else. That there's like this impression management where they don't want you to know about something else, or so they may tell a lie, and then you think, oh, okay, they have something really bad to hide, and it turns out it really wasn't that bad. So I have seen that as well. I mean, it's possible, you know, they don't want something else to come out. I don't know, but you're right. I think it does seem like they just, you know, they're gonna leave it as it is and hope that the judge rules in their favor.
Yeah. Hope that the grounds for disqualification have not been met. And of course, the danger in all of that is, well, what if somehow they come up with more proof later on? I mean, the case would still be going on. They could bring again, if you knew that information was out there that could hurt you. I mean, it's almost like the sword of Damocles over your head, right? But on the other hand, if you knew that you were correct, I mean, probably I'd be like logging on to my online bank account, printing out the records, running into court and say, hey, here, I'm showing you, look, I withdrew all this cash. This lends credibility to my story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
I think you're right about that.
I don't see that happening.
Yeah.
No, they're on the defensive right now. And so, I mean, you know, of course they are. They've had accusations made against them. They have to defend themselves. And, you know, we'll just have to see what the judge decides.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it there. But before we go, tell us a little bit more about your podcast and what you're up to these days.
So my podcast is called The Consult, Real FBI Profilers. And I'm the host, but I also have three other retired FBI profilers that join me on the show. And we discuss solved and unsolved cases. We are starting to get into more unsolved cases. And our show is really, it's really like as close as you can get to being in the room with the FBI's BAU. That's our motto. So, you know, if it's a solved case, we'll talk about the facts of the case. We'll talk about victimology and we'll go through what our analysis was and, you know, where we were right, where we were wrong. And then in some of the unsolved cases, now we, you know, get the facts of the case by talking to people, and then we do an analysis. And it really is very much like we're just sitting in a room talking about a case and talking about the behavior. And we really are just focused on the behavioral perspective of the case and the behavior that's exhibited before, during, and after the commission of a crime. And we've done a lot of interesting cases. We have probably about 25 shows out now, and it's, I really enjoy it. I find it very rewarding.
Well, that's great. And just for our listeners, I'll make a plug for Julia. So I worked with Julia. She's an incredible agent. And I've also seen her in-person presentation about profiling. I just, like, it was fascinating. And for those of you who do not have the opportunity to see Julia in person, I would recommend her podcast, The Consult. So that's it for today on the Law of the Case podcast. We'll see you next time. And I'm Alex Grant with special guest Julia Cowley.